Today is Monday, January 18th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, security fears overshadow presidential inauguration.
The ceremony, already altered because of the pandemic, will be even more restricted after the violence at the U.S. Capitol.
Also ahead, Uganda opposition candidate rejects presidential election results.
On the eve of the election, it was a military operation to arrest all our polling agents.
Plus, Americans mark the birthday of civil rights icon Martin Luther King. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S. On the steps of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, Joe Biden is set to be inaugurated Wednesday as the 46th president of the United States. The national special security event comes amid reports domestic extremist groups may again protest the presidential results. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
Armed guards in the nation's capital are working to ensure that this week's inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th president happens peacefully. The ceremony, already altered because of the pandemic, will be even more restricted after the violence at the U.S. Capitol January 6th. Biden's team says the inauguration will send a visual signal to Americans and the world about the resilience of the U.S. democracy. Kate Benningfield is the incoming White House communications director.
We're very much looking forward to President-elect Biden putting his hand on the Bible at noon on the 20th.
President Donald Trump does not plan to attend Biden's swearing-in, the first president in modern history to do so. Instead, Trump plans to hold a departure ceremony at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland before flying one last time on Air Force One to Palm Beach, Florida. He leaves the White House with a 29% job approval rating, the lowest in his presidency, according to the Pew Research Center. Around the country, state capitol buildings have also beefed up security in anticipation of protesters who falsely claim that the November 3rd election was stolen from Trump. In the city of Olympia, the capital of Washington State, high fencing was installed around the capitol building in anticipation of protests. Joe is a resident of Olympia in Washington State.
Well, I'm disappointed that we're at this point, that we have to put fences up to keep people that have no clue as what being an American is attacking our democracy.
John Hess is a Trump supporter in Washington State.
The fences and stuff are against people like me, because what's happened here is the state has recognized that the majority of the people don't believe that this election was legitimate. To defend the election against the majority of the people, this is what they're doing. So they're putting up the fences and bringing in armed guards in order to defend the stolen election.
In addressing a divided nation, Biden's inauguration speech will likely focus on unity. Kate Benningfield, the incoming White House communications director.
I think you can expect that this will be a moment where President-elect Biden will really work to try to turn the page on the divisiveness and the hatred of the last 4 years and really lay out a positive, optimistic vision for the country and lay out a way, lay out a path forward that really calls on all of us to work together.
An inauguration during a pandemic and a period of unrest, aiming to send a message to the nation and the world. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Defense officials say they are worried about an insider attack or other threat from service members involved in securing President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
This is prompting the FBI to vet all of the 25,000 National Guard troops coming into Washington for the event. This comes on top of the routine military reviews of service members for extremist connections. It underscores fears that some of the very people assigned to protect the city over the next days could present a threat to the incoming president and other VIPs in attendance. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy told the Associated Press, officials are conscious of the potential threat and warned commanders to be on the lookout for any problems within their ranks. I'm Julie Walker.
President-elect Joe Biden's team says he plans to roll back some of President Trump's most controversial policies and take steps to address the coronavirus pandemic on the first day of his presidency. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Incoming White House Communications Director Kate Bedingfield tells ABC's This Week Biden will work with Congress to pass his American Rescue Plan, which includes
an effort to fund a coordinated federal vaccine effort. It's an effort to get shots into American arms to ensure that we can once and for all finally get this virus under control and get our economy back on track.
Biden is planning a 10-day blitz of executive actions that will not require congressional action. Those include an end to Trump's restriction on immigration from some Muslim-majority countries and rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, as well as a mandate that people wear masks on federal property and during interstate travel. Ben Thomas, Washington.
As the country pivots to a Biden-era, a Republican congressman who voted to impeach President Trump is calling on his party to restore trust. A House impeachment manager, however, says they are going to do whatever it takes to lay out the case against Trump. Here again is AP's Julia Walker.
Republican Representative Peter Meyer says voting to impeach Trump was gut-wrenching.
It's not what is going to be politically expedient, but what we actually need for the country.
He says Republicans need to act in the best interest of the country.
I'm calling on my party to restore trust.
One of the House impeachment managers, Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro, says timing of the trial is being discussed between Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Senate.
We're going to do whatever we need to do to lay out the evidence to show the American people, and most of all the senators who are voting on this, that Donald Trump, through his words and actions, got these folks riled up on that day.
Their comments were made on ABC's This Week. I'm Julie Walker.
Today is a national holiday in the U.S., honoring the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He led the nonviolent struggle in the 1950s and 60s to promote civil rights and end racial segregation in America until his murder in April 1968. Dr. King's effective use of nonviolent methods was largely inspired by an Indian, Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi. His own Hindu-inspired activism and philosophy helped colonial India wrest independence from Britain in 1948. VOA's Adam Phillips looks back at the civil rights legend.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
That's Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, delivered to a 250,000 civil rights marchers in Washington, D.C., an iconic moment in recent American history. Much of the spirit of that plea for justice was rooted in the experience of Mohandas Gandhi, a continent and a generation away. In 1893, as a young Indian lawyer in South Africa, Gandhi was ejected from the first-class train seat he had paid for and told to sit among the other non-whites in third class. David Courtwright, the author of Gandhi and Beyond, says that was a moment that would profoundly affect the world.
Gandhi recognized early on the self-defeating nature of violence, how violence begets violence, and there is a cycle of action and reaction. Whenever we strike a blow, the other person will strike back. This vicious cycle of violence, Gandhi recognized that we had to break out of it.
Like Gandhi, who was a Hindu, Dr. Martin Luther King, a Christian minister, based his political activism on his religion. Just as Gandhi's Hinduism teaches that all human beings, even one's enemies or oppressors, are an expression of the divine with no less value than oneself, Reverend King and his followers were inspired by Jesus' command to turn the other cheek when your enemy strikes you, and to pray for him, suffer for him, and ultimately to forgive him.
Dr. King used to say that we will match your ability to inflict suffering by our willingness to suffer.
That's Andrew Young, the first African-American ambassador to the United Nations and one of King's closest friends and lieutenants. He has just finished watching Dare Not Walk Alone, a film documentary about the civil rights movement that includes footage from a nonviolent demonstration he led in 1964 in St. Augustine, Florida, as a young leader in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
And now I'm watching myself getting kicked and stomped. There was a picture of a young woman with a broken nose. I'm sure her nose is beautiful again. And she looks upon that physical beating as a mark of courage, as I do. that you were willing to confront evil and risk your life and not back down. The willingness to suffer for what you believe in is one of the highest virtues.
Like Andrew Young, Gandhi and King keenly understood that the moral dignity of nonviolent demonstrations, as conveyed through the media, could powerfully affect public opinion. Economic pressure through boycotts was another way that Dr. King's methods echoed those of Gandhi. Young recalls the 90 days of demonstrations and boycotts against segregated department stores in downtown Birmingham, Alabama, in 1963.
We never hit anybody. We never cussed anybody out. We never broke any windows. But we every day challenged the philosophy of racism in a way that it stopped economic enterprise, at least temporarily, so that the business community had to come to us after about 100 days and say, look, this has got to stop because you're putting us out of business. You are the aggressor with nonviolence in that you are defining the issue. You are staging the confrontation.
Gandhi and King's methods have inspired political movements around the world. One thinks of the reconciliation efforts in post-apartheid South Africa and the Dalai Lama's efforts on behalf of Tibetans. Robert Barnett, who founded the Department of Contemporary Tibetan Studies at Columbia University in New York, notes that the Dalai Lama paid tribute to Gandhi and his nonviolent method when he accepted his 1989 Nobel Peace Prize.
And there he's spoken quite a lot about compassion and trying to understand why Chinese people felt in the way they did when they took over China, and trying to go from that to saying we need to negotiate with these people and talk with these people, not to use violence against them.
The universality of what Gandhi called the force of truth and love is why Andrew Young says that Martin Luther King Day should not be regarded as only a holiday for African Americans.
Martin Luther King happened to be an Afro-American, but the message there is that we ought to be celebrating and studying nonviolence as a continuing option for growth and development of human civilization.
Thoughts for all Americans and people everywhere to remember on this Martin Luther King Day 2020. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is the Voice of America. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny's arrest as he arrived in Moscow has drawn widespread criticism from Western nations. German's foreign minister on Monday called it incomprehensible and, along with others, called for Navalny's immediate release. Navalny was detained at passport control at Moscow's Sheremetyevo airport after flying in Sunday evening from Berlin, where he was treated following a poisoning in August that he blames on the Kremlin. Billionaire Samsung heir Lee Yang-yong is heading back to prison after a South Korean court handed him a 2.5-year sentence for his involvement in the 2016 corruption scandal. One of Lee's lawyers said the decision was regrettable. His side says the 2015 deal at issue in the case was part of a normal business activity. It wasn't immediately known whether Lee would appeal. Prosecutors have sought a 9-year prison term. Lee helms the Samsung Group in his capacity as vice chairman of Samsung Electronics, one of the world's largest makers of computer chips and smartphones. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Uganda opposition presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, has rejected the results of last Thursday's presidential election because of what he calls widespread irregularities and illegalities. Wine told Daybreak Africa's James Batty he will present the evidence as soon as the internet is restored in Uganda.
Well, James, as you know, on the eve of the election, it was a military operation to arrest all our polling agents and confiscate all the documents, including letters of appointment for them and all the money that we're using for facilitation. Now, before the election, General Museveni ordered for a complete shutdown of the internet to ensure that the world is not watching and Uganda is kept in the dark. And that means, therefore, on the day of the election, General Museveni and his lieutenants had a field day. The military was everywhere, staffing, critics, ballot papers, and stopping some people from taking part in the election. Therefore, there was widespread irregularities and illegalities. We therefore reject the results of this election with the contempt that it deserves. As soon as the internet is restored, we are going to show the world the evidence of our claim to victory. We therefore called upon the people of Uganda and continue calling upon them and the people of the world to reject the result that was fabricated by General Museveni and his lieutenants trying to undermine the will of the people of Uganda.
Do you plan to go to the courts of Uganda to make your case?
Everybody knows that the courts, the judiciary of Uganda is undermined by General Museveni. It is a mockery. It is firmly in the pocket of General Museveni. However, we have mentioned it that we have every nonviolent and every peaceful option on the table, and that also includes peaceful protest against this usurpation. But we also look at calling upon the developing partners and citizens of the world and all the donors and the people that wish Uganda well not to recognize the Museveni imposition of himself on the people of Uganda.
Your movement won some seats in parliament. I would say that was a success. What do you make of the performance of your party in parliament?
Well, it is rather weird that our party members won massively, even though the majority of them actually had much more results. The member of parliament results were relayed, but the presidential results were not relayed, and that disturbs everybody. I'm not allowed to talk about that. As we speak right now, I am under house arrest. More than 400 soldiers are stationed around my house. Many of them have jumped over the fence and they've taken control of my compound. I am not allowed to leave my house.
That's Daybreak Africa's James Bate speaking with Uganda opposition presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi from Kampala. A spokesperson for the Electoral Commission of Uganda, Paul Bekenya, told James Bate that the courts are open for all candidates from last week's presidential and parliamentary election. The commission said 76-year-old President Yoweri Museveni won 58.64% of the vote, while the main opposition candidate, Robert Kyagulanyi, known as Bobi Wine, won 34.83%. Bekenya said the electoral process was transparent from start to finish and that President Museveni won convincingly. Bekenya said any candidate or candidates feeling dissatisfied should seek redress in the courts. Jordan has become one of the world's first countries to start coronavirus vaccinations for United Nations registered refugees, according to the UN Refugee Agency and the Royal Palace. As part of the kingdom's national vaccination drive that began last week, anyone living there, including refugees and asylum seekers, is entitled to receive the shot without charge. Jordan hosts hundreds of thousands of refugees from the region's conflict in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Libya. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Some 80% of refugees sheltering from neighboring conflicts live in Jordan's urban areas and will be vaccinated in these local health clinics. The UN Refugee Agency says it is working closely with Jordan's Ministry of Health to administer the vaccination to those housed in the Za'atari and Azraq camps for Syrian refugees. Last Thursday, 43 Iraqis and Syrians were the first batch of refugees vaccinated in the northern towns of Irbid and Mafraq near the border with Syria. UNHCR Jordan spokesman Francesco Burt told VOA.
But there are many more that sign up. There's a government portal where everybody needs to register. So far, about 250,000 people have signed up, including refugees. That depends on the availability of doses that the Jordanian government has available. They have about 3 million doses so far, so they plan to cover about 25% of the population in the next month.
The UNHCR says Jordan has included refugees in its national response plan since the beginning of the pandemic. Dominic Bartich, the agency's representative to Jordan, said that reducing the spread of COVID-19 now necessitates that the most vulnerable people in our society and around the world can access vaccines, no matter where they come from. COVID-19 is the illness caused by the coronavirus. Burt says the pandemic has greatly impacted refugee resettlements to other countries in the West.
that's part of the problem with COVID and travel restrictions. But we've seen some resuming. It really depends on the country regulation that changed so fast. They've discovered new streams of the virus, so that's very much dependent on that. But some refugees have departed in the past months, not many. That will all depend on the vaccine rollout and regulation in the coming months.
The UNHCR says the number of refugees with the infection in Jordan has remained low at 1.6% compared with 3% among the general population, but poverty rates among the refugees have spiked by 18% since the outbreak last March. Both the Jordanian government and the UN say they need additional funding to aid more than 1.5 million refugees hosted in the country. The UNHCR Jordan is appealing for $370 million to help the refugees. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Riots and looting shook parts of Tunisia early Sunday, days after the country marked the 10th anniversary of the resignation of longtime President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in an Arab Spring Revolution. The riots also came as Prime Minister Hichem Mechichi announced a major ministerial reshuffle Saturday. Edwin Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Arab media broadcast amateur video of crowds of young men setting fire and looting banks and private businesses in a second day of violence in a number of Tunisian cities. The Interior Ministry reported that 242 people were arrested in the wake of the violence. Prime Minister Hichem Mechichi said in a public address Saturday that he was presenting a ministerial reshuffle to Parliament to try and alleviate corruption, unemployment, and economic woes plaguing the country. He says that the coming months pose a serious threat and reforms must be made to the economy, along with efforts to redress social injustice and underdevelopment. More cooperation is also needed at the ministerial level, he adds, and this is the reason for the decision to reshuffle the cabinet. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq, speaking to VOA from Tunisia, says the majority of the rioters were teenagers and young men, and that police have been reluctant to crack down on them due to criticism of brutality by various political parties. Sadiq notes that many Tunisians are not happy with the current situation, either economically or politically, and many feel that politicians don't care about the fate of ordinary people.
This model of the Arab Spring is facing a lot of difficulties despite all the Western media coverage and the image that this is a success. Inside the country, people are not feeling or seeing any success. They don't have bread, they don't have water. The security of the country is also problematic.
The government announced a four-day lockdown last week, saying the move was due to a surge in the number of coronavirus cases. Some analysts, however, say the lockdown was meant to prevent possible violence on the anniversary of the departure of former President Ben Ali on January 14, 2011. Tunisia has been facing serious economic problems in the years since the departure of Ben Ali, and the recent coronavirus crisis has left the country with a budget shortfall. Tunisians also say the government does not have enough money to buy enough vaccines for its population. The Arab Spring Revolution in Tunisia broke out in December 2010 after a young vegetable seller by the name of Mohamed Bouazizi set fire to himself to protest economic conditions and alleged police brutality. It was the first of revolutions across the Arab world in places like Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. Despite the overthrow of dictatorial governments like that of Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in Tunisia in 2011, many of the demands and aspirations of protesters were never fulfilled, leading to periodic outbursts of public anger like the latest rioting and violence of the past several days. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
On Monday, Tunisian authorities said they had arrested more than 200 people for taking part in the protests. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofoedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.